Hi, welcome to our growth summary of Essentialism by Greg McKeown. This is a productivity book that helps you get more done by doing less. It teaches you to focus only on what's really important and to say no to things that distract you. Instead of feeling overwhelmed by too many tasks to do, you'll learn how to prioritize and concentrate on what truly matters in your life and work. Greg McKeown is a New York Times bestselling author of Essentialism and Effortless. He's a leadership consultant and public speaker, having worked with companies like Google, Apple, and Microsoft. His work has been featured in Harvard Business Review, The New Yorker, and Time Magazine. And he also earned his MBA from Stanford University. So if you want to improve your productivity and to focus on what truly matters, this book, Essentialism by Greg McKeown, is a must read. It teaches us that if you don't set your own priorities, then others will set them for you. So this book is not about doing more things faster, but about doing the right things, the ones that truly count. Imagine instead of being overwhelmed by endless tasks, you could cut out distractions, prioritize effectively, and focus on what will make the biggest impact in your life and work. That's exactly what Essentialism aims to help us do. So whether you're looking to simplify your schedule, reduce stress, or make meaningful progress on an important project, this book provides a framework to help us achieve that. Now, I think a great companion to this book is another one called Deep Work by Cal Newport. That book teaches that the secret to learning and also productivity is focusing deeply without distractions for extended periods of time. As Cal Newport writes, "To learn hard things quickly, you must focus intensely without distraction," end quote. So, also check out our summary of that book, Deep Work by Cal Newport, on Growth Summary. But now let's jump into the key lessons from Essentialism so we can start applying them to our lives right away. The first four chapters of this book are about the core principles of what it means to be an essentialist. So that brings us to the first big lesson in this book, which is all about the core of essentialism. The foundational principles of essentialism include setting priorities, practicing choice, doing less, and making trade-offs. So let's begin with the Chapter 1 summary. Our first point is to set your priorities or others will do it for you. There's a story in this book of a busy Silicon Valley executive who was so overwhelmed with trivial tasks others were asking him to do that he almost quit. But instead, someone advised him to simply stop doing the work that he felt wasn't essential. And so he did. At first, people around him felt upset. But soon they accepted it, and this executive ended up enjoying his job a lot more and even had more time for his family. Greg McKeown, the author of this book, shares a similar personal story. When he decided to attend a meeting for work on the same day that his wife gave birth, later he realized that his priorities were way off because he had let other people set priorities for him instead of doing that himself. The next point is about the paradox of success. As people become successful, they get more opportunities and requests of them, but that can pull them into too many different directions. So instead of focusing on what made them successful, they begin spreading themselves thin and make little progress on anything. Even big companies fall into this trap when they become successful and then they try to do too much at once and end up losing their edge. It was the great business author Jim Collins who said that successful companies fail because of the undisciplined pursuit of more. So this book is basically the opposite. After all, the subtitle of this book is The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. So this book outlines a three-step solution to this problem of modern overwhelm and distraction. The first step will be to identify what is most essential by first exploring many options to figure out what really matters in our lives. The second step will be to eliminate the non-essential by removing distractions and having the courage to say no to others. And the third step is to make execution easier with a routine. So with routines and habits, that makes it easier to do the essential. And we need to accept the reality that we can't do everything, that there are always trade-offs. That brings us to chapter 2. The big point here is to not forget that you have a power to choose. The author of this book shares his personal story about being in law school because others had said that would give him a lot of options. But in law school, he felt stuck and unsatisfied because he was unable to dedicate the time he wanted to his passion of business writing. And so he wasn't doing great or awful at anything that he wanted to, either school or his passion work. He was just being average at everything. So one day he thought about what he really wanted, and he realized that he could choose to leave law school, even if that meant going against people's expectations. And by doing so, that allowed him to focus on what really mattered to him, and he started following a path that aligned with his true values. That eventually led him to getting an MBA at Stanford, then writing in the Harvard Business Review, and eventually to this book and becoming a New York Times bestselling author and a leadership consultant for so many big companies. The next point in this chapter is about learned helplessness. In an experiment by the positive psychology researcher Martin Seligman, he found that dogs that were not able to stop electric shocks from happening eventually gave up trying. But dogs that had control over the shocks kept on exerting effort. So that shows when we feel powerless, then we might stop trying, even though we still have the ability to do something, to make choices. So this author says it's a good example of the fact that while we can't control everything in life, we can always choose how we respond to the options available to us. Now, I'm going to connect this to another book. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychologist who survived the Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Afterward, he wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, sharing his experiences and his philosophy on finding purpose in life. In that book, he wrote, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing. The last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." End quote. And I can see that under the surface, this idea from Viktor Frankl strongly influenced this chapter of Essentialism on us having the power to choose. But you can read more about that idea in our summary of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl on Growth Summary. That brings us to chapter 3. The first point here is that less effort can equal more results. The author Greg McKeown tells a childhood story about delivering newspapers and earning £1 per hour. That's in the UK. And then he realized he could make £6 per hour washing cars for his neighbors. So very early on, he realized that earning more doesn't always mean working harder. It depends more on what you work on. Later, as a young adult, he was working in customer service for a coaching company, and he realized that his job really came down to one key skill, which was stopping the clients from canceling. So by getting really good at that one thing, he ended up getting paid way more because that's what he was getting paid for. And this whole idea connects to the 80-20 rule, which you've probably heard about. Very simply, it means that 80% of our results in almost anything tend to come from about 20% of our efforts. The next point here is to do less, but do it better. This slogan from the minimalist designer Dieter Rams sums up the essentialist way: do less, but better. It means focusing on fewer things, but doing them exceptionally well. Warren Buffett is a great example of this. He knew early in his life that he couldn't trust himself to make hundreds of correct investing decisions. So instead, he really focused on just a few companies, but made sure that he believed in those companies fully and then bet very heavily on them. As a result, 90% of his wealth has come from just 10 investments that he's made. Now, I'll connect this to another book. It's from Tim Ferriss, the author of The 4-Hour Workweek. So, Tim Ferriss said that being busy is a form of laziness, lazy thinking, and indiscriminate action. Being busy is most often used as a guise for avoiding the few critically important but uncomfortable actions, end quote. So, in his book, The 4-Hour Workweek, Tim says that as a young entrepreneur building his first major business, a sports supplement company, he worked so hard that he barely had time to sleep. Then he discovered the 80-20 rule, which changed everything. He realized by looking at his sales metrics that 20% of his customers made up most of his profits and rarely caused problems, and those were his wholesale buyers who made large orders from his company. So, he focused on finding more of those top 20% of customers, finding more customers like that, and forgot about the other 80%. He intentionally tried to discourage those kinds of customers. As a result, his business grew much faster, and at the same time, he got a lot more free time and freedom even to travel around the world. So if you want to learn more advice from him about productivity and business, check out our summary of The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And that brings us to Chapter 4. The first point here is about the reality of making trade-offs. You can't do everything, so you have to choose what to focus on. Now, trade-offs are hard, because they're always about picking between two things that we want. But instead of seeing it as missing out on something, think about it as choosing to do what you want to be really great at. When we try to do everything, that usually means we're not great at anything. It's kind of like being a company with a vague mission statement that talks about buzzwords like innovation, excellence, and vision, but it ends up not meaning anything to anybody. The next point here is to avoid a straddling strategy. Southwest Airlines became the best investment in the stock market, the S&P 500, over a 30-year period. How did they do it? By focusing entirely on a singular strategy of being the low-cost, no-frills airline. And to do that, they had to make trade-offs. So they did things like only offering point-to-point flights, having no assigned seating, and having no in-flight meals. Now, after their success, competitors tried to copy them, like Continental Airlines. But the problem was they tried to copy some parts of the strategy while still keeping their traditional model intact. And that's called straddling. It's trying to follow two strategies at once. And it led to them losing hundreds of millions of dollars. The business expert Michael Porter explains that straddling doesn't work because a sustainable business strategy requires making trade-offs with some other strategic position. So now here's a quiz question. According to Greg McKeown, what is a common reason people lose focus as they become more successful? Is it A, they are distracted by new opportunities and requests? B, they take on too many trivial tasks from the start? C, they don't set clear goals? Or D, they lack the right skills? So the correct answer here is A. A common reason people lose focus after becoming successful is being distracted by new opportunities and requests. Now that brings us to the second major lesson from this book, which is number 2, to discover what really matters. Explore your options to clarify and prioritize what truly matters in your life. So the next 5 chapters focus more on exploring your options. This is a key step before we begin narrowing down and prioritizing to the most important few options. So let's go into the chapter 5 summary. First point here is to escape, to think without distractions. We're often too busy to stop and think about whether we're working on what really matters to us. Couple examples. One executive spent 35 hours a week in meetings and as a result had no time to reflect. Another stayed at a company 5 years too long because he was too caught up in everyday tasks to think about leaving. So to avoid this trap, it's important we set aside time just for thinking without any distractions. But how do we make time for focused thinking? There are some famous examples. They include Isaac Newton, who spent 2 years in semi-isolation writing Principia Mathematica, and Bill Gates, who takes a think week a couple times every year to disconnect and read, and he was doing that even when Microsoft was growing really fast. The author of this book created his own routine for escaping by working on this book from 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. without interruptions, and he let people know that he was in monk mode with an email message that would auto-reply to any incoming emails. He says another way that we can create this space in our lives is to start your day with 20 minutes of inspirational reading. And that helps to set a focused tone for the rest of the day. This author recommends books like Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, As a Man Thinketh by James Allen, and we have summaries of both those books on Gross Summary. He also recommends books on Zen, Taoism, Confucianism, as well as the Bible, Quran, Torah, and other religious and spiritual books. Now, I want to connect this to another book. Society often pushes us to focus on what we don't like about our external circumstances, but those can be hard or confusing to change. But there's the classic success book called As a Man Thinketh by James Allen, which teaches that changing our thinking is key to improving our mental and physical well-being. That author wrote, "A man cannot directly choose his circumstances, but he can choose his thoughts, and by doing so, shape his circumstances." End quote. And while that may sound a little far-fetched at first, today there are scientists like Robert Sapolsky who confirm this idea, showing that negative thoughts trigger stress chemicals called glucocorticoids, which do slowly harm our health over time in a very strong way. But you can check out more about that in our summary of As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. Now that brings us to chapter 6. This one is all about focusing on what's truly important. The author shares a story about a famous journalism teacher named Charlie O'Sims, who taught his students how to find the lead of a news story. You see, instead of just reporting the facts, the lead communicates why the story matters to the reader. So in this teacher's class, his students tried writing a news article about an event. It was a school conference where the teachers were all leaving. And they all tried to come up with what the lead was, and they all got it wrong. And at the end, this teacher revealed the real lead, which was No School Thursday. So this really highlights the fact that journalism and also essentialism is all about learning to focus on what really matters, not just trivial details. The author says we can keep a journal to find the lead in our own lives. In our busy lives, it's easy to lose sight of what really matters in a sea of distractions. So the author suggests keeping a journal to help cut through the noise. Write down your thoughts daily, but he recommends starting small by writing less than you want to, so you don't overwhelm yourself like many beginners do. Then, every 90 days, review your journal entries, and this will help you spot long-term patterns and trends. This whole process helps you to see the lead in your life, what's truly important. Next, we have Chapter 7. This one was all about rediscovering the importance of play. As kids, play comes naturally to us, but over time, we're taught to think play is unproductive and unimportant. And partly this is due to a school system modeled after factories and the industrial work. However, play is actually essential. Researchers have found play helps our brains to become more flexible, creative, and adaptable. There are many benefits of play. Playing not only helps us to explore creative solutions and adapt to different situations, but it also strengthens the part of our brain responsible for planning, strategy, and self-control. Plus, play reduces stress, making it easier to handle challenges in our lives and work. This author suggests thinking about the type of play you loved as a kid, and finding ways to bring that play into your life today. So here's another quiz question. What routine did the author establish to focus on his writing without distractions? Was it A, attending fewer meetings throughout the week? B, taking a yearly week off to think and prioritize? C, blocking off 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. with no interruptions? Or D, setting aside 20 minutes each morning for meditation? The correct answer here is C, blocking off 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. with no interruptions. And that brings us to the third big lesson, which is the power of saying no. This next part of the book is all about learning how to set boundaries and say no, so you can focus on your essential opportunities. So here's chapter 8, summary. This chapter begins with the author's troubled relationship with sleep. Like many hardworking, ambitious people, the author used to think sleep was a waste of time. He tried extreme sleep schedules, like only sleeping 20 minutes every 4 hours, or even pulling all-nighters once a week, hoping that would make him more productive. His wife, who didn't like these habits, changed his perspective by showing him a research article that proved sleep actually boosts performance. So now he believes that sleep is essential. The author realized that not getting enough sleep actually made him worse at planning and prioritizing those higher-level mental tasks. There's the famous 10,000-hour rule study. What most people don't know is that the top violinists in that study who reached mastery faster also got an extra hour of sleep each night compared to the others. So sleep isn't wasted time. Your brain is busy creating new connections and organizing everything you learned during the day. So today, the author believes that getting 8 hours of sleep is the best way to protect our greatest asset, meaning your mind, so you have the ability to prioritize and focus. That brings us to chapter 9. The first point here is about the 90% rule. So this first comes from the rule from Derek Sievers, which is called the hell yeah or no rule. Basically, that means if you're not super excited about something, then it's a no. So to make that idea more practical, McKeown turned this into what he calls the 90% rule. So when you have too many options, you'll rate the most important aspect of them from 1 to 100, and then eliminate anything below a 90. So we're eliminating anything that we're not very excited about, or that doesn't have very strong potential opportunity. Here's an example. When this author was choosing students for a class he was teaching, he had to choose about half the students who applied. So he first scored each candidate from 1 to 100, and he accepted the obvious yes candidates who scored 90 or higher. However, he felt conflicted about the middle range candidates, those in the 70s to 80, and felt it would take a lot of time and effort to judge if they were a good fit for the class. So to simplify the process, he decided to reject anyone who wasn't an obvious fit, scoring 90 or more, and so they could only focus on the very clear yes candidates in the class. This decision brought immense clarity and a sense of freedom, and it made the whole process much easier. The next point here is the importance of saying no. As we grow more experienced or established in a field, we usually face too many choices and opportunities. So the biggest challenge is often learning to say no to most of them, so that we can focus on what truly matters and our greatest opportunities. By only saying yes to things that meet very high standards, we make space for doing truly important work. So this author recommends that in your career or business, don't just go for any good opportunity. Find something that fits very well with your passion, skills, and what people need to find your point of highest contribution. Now, I'll connect this to another book, one of the most popular self-help books in recent years, which is called Ikigai. And it explains a Japanese idea that helps people live with more purpose, happiness, and well-being, and that's called Ikigai. The authors say this concept is a big reason why people in Japan live longer and healthier than people in many other countries do. So what is Ikigai? Well, it means a reason for being. Ikigai is about having a purpose or passion that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We're happier and even might live longer when we do what we love with people we care about. And that book says you can find your Ikigai or life purpose by asking yourself three questions. Number one is, what do you love? Number two is, what can you be great at? And number three is, what will the world pay you for? So whatever is at the intersection of those three answers, that is your Ikigai. And you can learn more about that idea in our summary of the book Ikigai on Growth Summary. Now here's another quiz question. What is the concept called where you rate options from 1 to 100 and cut anything below 90 to focus on only the most valuable opportunities? Is it A, the 80-20 rule? B, the hell yeah or no rule? C, the margin of safety rule? Or D, the 90% rule? So the correct answer here is D, the 90% rule. The next big idea is number four, eliminate the unnecessary. So the next few chapters will be all about how to eliminate what's not important and cut out what's not essential in our lives, so we can focus on the few truly great and important opportunities that we have for meaningful progress. That brings us to chapter 10. The first point is that mission statements are overrated. Many companies rely on mission statements to set their direction and vision, but these statements are often vague and interchangeable, filled with buzzwords like innovation and value-driven. While they may sound good, they usually don't help people in the company make decisions on a daily basis. On the other hand, we have quarterly objectives, and those are very concrete goals, but they're uninspiring, like increasing leads by 10%. So what's the solution? This author recommends that we come up with an essential intent, and that is a statement that's both inspirational and concrete. Instead of a generic mission statement, you can write down your essential intent. It's both inspiring and specific. Here's an example. Martha Lane Fox, the UK's first digital champion, set the goal to get everyone in the UK online by 2012. And that was a motivating goal, yet clear enough that even junior employees could make decisions based on it. They knew whether something would take them closer or further away from that essential intent. That brings us to chapter 11. The first point is, saying no takes courage. Many of us say yes out of habit or people-pleasing, but saying no often earns respect later on, even though it can feel awkward at first. While we might get a quick boost from saying yes and seeing someone's approval, we often later feel guilty for overcommitting. So a great example of how to say no comes from designer Paul Rand. When Steve Jobs asked him for multiple design options for a logo, Paul Rand said no. He said he would create only one, and that one would solve Jobs' problem. So even though he didn't give Steve Jobs what he asked for, Paul Rand earned his respect, and Steve Jobs later called him the most professional person he'd ever worked with. Next point is that saying no requires clarity about what matters to us. To confidently say no, we need to be clear about what we're saying yes to, what is important to us. An example in this book comes from another author named Stephen Covey, who wrote the best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. So there was one time when Stephen Covey and his daughter spent weeks planning this special father-daughter date night. And then, on that same evening, an important business person invited this author to a dinner. And Stephen Covey turned it down, saying he already had important plans with his daughter. This moment strengthened their bond and demonstrated Covey's lifelong principle of putting first things first, with family being his top priority. Now, a tip from this author is that you can say no without using the word no itself, like we can say, I'm honored, but I have prior commitments, and that usually makes it less awkward or difficult. Now, I'm going to connect this to another book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. In that book, Stephen Covey shares his strategies for productivity and leadership, and he explains that all the tasks we have can fall into two categories. They're important or not important, and they are urgent or not urgent. Covey says we often spend too much time on tasks that are urgent but not important. Those are other people's priorities that distract us from what really matters. For example, when we get a notification first thing in the morning and end up spending half the day putting out some fire of someone else's priority. Instead, he recommends we focus much more time, dedicated large blocks of time, on what he calls quadrant two activities. Those are important but not urgent tasks, like building relationships and improving our skill set, and that is really what leads to long-term success. So you can read more in our summary of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And that brings us to chapter 12. The first point is about sunk cost bias. Sunk cost bias makes us afraid to quit when we really should. This bias is when we keep working on something that's not working because we don't want to lose the time, money, or effort we've already invested. Sunk cost bias applies to projects. It can apply to jobs, even relationships. We think if we just stick with it a little bit longer, we can make it work. But often, it's smarter to cut our losses and invest our resources into something more promising. Related to this is the endowment effect discovered by Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and psychologist. So the endowment effect shows how we tend to overvalue things we own compared to things we don't own. In one study, people were given a coffee cup, and those who owned the coffee cup would only sell it for over $5. But other participants who did not own the coffee cup would only pay less than $3 to buy it. So it shows we overvalue what we currently have. So how do we overcome these biases? Here are three ways. First is by asking yourself, if I didn't already have this project or opportunity, how hard would I work or pay to get it? Second is to get a neutral opinion. Someone else can often see much more clearly when it's time for us to move on. And the third strategy is to try a reverse pilot study. This is basically where you stop doing the task or project and see if anyone notices or cares. A story from this book is that a LinkedIn executive stopped doing this fancy weekly report and found that no one cared or even mentioned it, proving it was just a big waste of time for the employees he was managing. That brings us to chapter 13. The first point is that editing is underrated. At the Oscars, there's a strong correlation between the movies that win Best Picture Award and those that win the Best Editing Award. Yet most of us don't pay much attention to the second award. We tend to overlook the importance of editing. Now, in life, editing is like essentialism. We're cutting out what's unnecessary so that truly important things can shine. So here's how to edit in your life. Editing your life means cutting off options, which can feel intimidating. However, making trade-offs is essential if we want to be effective. You have to let go of good things to focus on what's truly great. So to do that, we can look for ways to simplify tasks. Like one employee who skipped a long weekly meeting and simply asked their coworker what happened, thereby condensing 2 hours into 10 minutes. We can also practice restraint by doing less, sitting back, waiting, and listening, instead of jumping in and overcommitting your time and energy to something you may later regret. That brings us to chapter 14. This one is all about setting boundaries, and how setting boundaries gives you control. When you set clear boundaries up front, that frees you from having to say no repeatedly later on. So decide what's most important to you and let others know. To pick out one story mentioned in this chapter, the author Clayton Christensen refused to work on weekends because he'd committed that time to his family and faith. While the others he worked with weren't happy about it at first, they adjusted. Now, if he had said yes once to working on a weekend, he would probably have been expected to work many weekends, but by sticking to his boundaries, he protected time for what mattered most to him. So here's another quiz question. What is an effective way to overcome sunk cost bias, according to Greg McKeown? Is it A, increase effort and stick with the project? B, focus on the amount of money already invested? C, ask yourself if you would work hard to get it if you didn't already have it? Or D, try to sell the project to someone else? So the correct answer here is C. Ask yourself how hard you would work to get it if you didn't already have it. Now that brings us to big idea number 5, which is to execute the essential with ease. So this next 5 chapters are all about practical ways that we can execute our essential activities and tasks more easily and more effectively through preparation, routines, and daily wins. So now we have chapter 15. So the first point here is to practice extra preparation. Life is full of surprises, and the best way to stay ahead is by preparing more in advance. As an example, this author passed his Stanford graduate school with minimal stress by working on his assignments very early. So even if unexpected issues came up for him, which they did, he still had time to complete his important projects. In another example given, the explorer Roald Amundsen succeeded in being the first person to reach the South Pole because he brought more than double the necessary supplies and planned for every possible problem. His competitor, who packed only the bare minimum and assumed things would go smoothly, did not make it. A tip is to add 50% to your time estimates. We usually underestimate how long tasks will last, so it's smart to add 50% more time than you think you need. As an example, if you estimate a project will take 2 weeks, you can plan for 3 weeks instead. Research proves that people consistently misjudge how long things will take. Like in a study by Daniel Kahneman, where students were asked how long it would take them to finish a project. On average, they believed they would finish in 27 days if everything went perfectly, and 49 days if everything went wrong. But in the end, the amount of time they actually needed to finish the project, on average, was 56 days. That's why we should be adding extra buffer space, which gives you a cushion of time to handle unexpected delays and will make you more effective in the long run. Now, I'll connect this to another book, The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. It's a best-selling book that explains how our mindset can make or break our financial life. That one focuses on the emotional side of investing because fear and greed often lead to poor investing decisions, even more often than math. So one key idea to reduce our financial stress and mistakes is keeping a margin of safety. This concept of margin of safety was promoted by Warren Buffett and his mentor Benjamin Graham. So that means having a buffer in your investment strategy to protect against unexpected losses and market changes. In practice, having a margin of safety means investing in safer options, even if it means slower growth. It also means having an emergency fund that lasts a few months at least, and also being cautious about how much we expect to earn in the future, not overestimating how much we will have in the future. So if you want to learn more about the psychology of money and concepts about how to think about finance and investing, check out our summary of that book too. Next, we have chapter 16. First point is about the theory of constraints. In The Goal, which is a book about business systems, a factory manager learns that to improve productivity at his factory, he needs to find and remove the biggest constraint, which is the slowest part of the process. This is illustrated when the manager goes hiking and realizes the slowest kid, who's named Herbie, is holding everyone back. By putting Herbie at the front of the line and lightening his load, the group as a whole can keep walking forward much faster by removing that constraint. In the same way, we can become much more productive by removing blocks. So we often can make progress faster by eliminating obstacles rather than adding more quick fix solutions, which is often our automatic approach. So to do this, we should first clarify what we want to achieve, and then we ask ourselves, what's the one thing slowing me down here? And once you identify the bottleneck, the constraint in your process, then you can work to reduce or eliminate it. For example, if you're waiting on a coworker for a key piece of a project, you can go up to them and ask how you can assist them to overcome their own obstacles to complete their part, and that will lead to you getting results faster. So here's another quiz question. According to Greg McKeown, how much extra time should you add to your project estimates to account for unexpected delays? Is it A, 25%, B, 50%, C, 75%, or D, 100%? The correct answer here is B, 50%. And next we have a big lesson number 6, which is build habits and routines for success. So this next part will be all about developing routines and habits to turn our essential actions into automatic behaviors. So beginning with chapter 17, this one's all about aiming for small daily wins. Motivation comes from small consistent actions much more than aiming for a big win all at one time. So it's smarter for us to begin with small steps and to build momentum. For example, when this author wants to begin writing, he might begin with a tweet, and he'll do a few tweets and see which one resonates, and then he'll expand that into an article, and eventually that may make it into a book. This approach is a lot more effective than trying to start with a big project like writing a book. To keep track of our small daily wins, we can use visual tools like progress charts to track our daily actions and keep up the momentum. Next, we have chapter 18. This one begins with talking about the importance of routine. According to research by Duke University, about 40% of our daily actions are automatic. Our brains help us focus on what matters most by turning repeated tasks into automatic habits and routines. You see, the more we repeat a routine, the stronger the brain's neural connections become to do those actions, making them almost effortless. For example, Michael Phelps, the swimmer with the most Olympic gold medals in history, he followed a very strict routine that began hours before each race, starting with his stretches and what music he listened to. And this whole routine helped him perform at his best by eliminating the need to think. So here are some steps on how to create powerful new routines. First, we can replace old triggers with new ones. So we can, here we swap unhelpful habits with better ones, but keep the same triggers. For example, when your morning alarm goes off, maybe you have the habit of checking your phone, but instead we can use that alarm going off as a trigger to start reading right away. A second way is to use physical reminders. So we set up cues to support a new habit. An example from the author's life is he placed his journal next to his phone in his bag so that when he grabbed his phone to recharge it at nighttime, he would see the journal right there as a physical reminder and he would be reminded to write. And in the same way, we can set up these physical reminders or cues in our daily lives to trigger important habits that we want to have. And the third tip is to tackle the hardest task first. Prioritize the most challenging task early in the day to make everything else feel easier and help your day flow more smoothly. Some other productivity authors call this eating the frog, and we even have a whole book on that idea called Eat the Frog by Brian Tracy. And I'm also going to connect this to another book, which is probably the most popular book on habits, which is Atomic Habits by James Clear. So that book explains that success isn't about making a big change all at once, but just about getting 1% better every day. These small daily improvements of 1% add up day by day and compound and lead to huge life-changing results. As James Clear wrote, habits are the compound interest of self-improvement. And he also said, if you can get 1% better each day for 1 year, you'll end up 37 times better by the time you're done, end quote, meaning after 1 year. So you can read a lot more about that in our summary of Atomic Habits by James Clear. Now here's another quiz question. What happens as we repeat routines over time? A. We feel the consistent motivation of small wins. B. We must rely more on willpower to complete tasks. C. Our daily habits become triggered automatically. Or D. Our brain's neural connections strengthen, making actions easier. So the correct answer is D. Our brain's neural connections strengthen, making actions easier as we repeat routines day after day. That brings us to big idea number 7, which is to stay focused and present. So the next couple chapters are all about focusing on what's important now and continually refining our priorities to be an essentialist. So beginning with chapter 19, this one is all about asking yourself what's really important right now. There's a story about Larry Jelwicks, who is a high school rugby coach who led his team to 20 national championships in 36 years. And he did that by teaching his players to focus on the present by asking what's important now. This would help them to quickly let go of past mistakes and to focus on the current play where their actions would make a difference. In our lives, we can get stuck thinking about the past or worrying about the future, but the only moment we can take action is in now. So to practice this, we can slow down and consider what really needs to be done right now. A couple other tips, we can also journal our future plans or thoughts, and that helps to clear our minds to help us focus on now. And we can learn some mindfulness techniques like taking a deep breath to help ourselves stay present. And that brings us to the last chapter of this book, chapter 20. This one is all about how essentialism can become your identity. Over time, essentialism isn't just something you practice, it can be something you become. By consistently choosing to eliminate the unimportant and focus on what truly matters, you can embody the essentialist mindset. Mahatma Gandhi is an inspiring example of this. He simplified his own life, renounced almost all his possessions, and gave up his privileged lifestyle to focus entirely on India's independence, becoming father of the nation. So, this book finishes up with 3 massive benefits of living as an essentialist. When we live this essentialism philosophy, that will give us more clarity by helping you focus on the shortness of life and what truly matters to you. It also provides more control, because when you prioritize your own life, others can't impose their priorities on you. Lastly, it brings more peace and happiness, allowing you to live on your own terms and confidently say no to things that do not matter to you. And finally, we have a quiz question. What question did that rugby coach teach his players to ask to help them stay focused on the present? Was it A, what's important now? B, what's our next goal? C, how can I improve? Or D, what did I do wrong? So the correct answer here is A, what's important now? Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.